Akatra Foundation presents the Akatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI. Welcome, deep divers, to the Akatra Dialogue. Today, we're diving into something pretty profound, maybe even startling, about one of the most iconic figures of the last century, Mother Teresa.
That's right. We're looking at the book Mother Teresa, Come Be My Light, which is basically a collection of her private writings.
And our mission here really is to explore this this huge paradox that the book reveals. It seriously challenges what many of us thought we knew about her faith, about holiness itself.
It really does.
We think you'll find some surprising things here, maybe see her in a more human light.
Absolutely. The core insight from Come Be My Light is, it's quite revolutionary for many. It reveals that for almost 50 years, pretty much her entire famous ministry, Mother Teresa, lived with this intense, painful, almost constant spiritual darkness.
Darkness. You mean like doubt or?
Much deeper than doubt. She described feeling a profound absence of God, a real emptiness in her soul. And this just stands in such stark contrast to that public image, you know, the unwavering faith we all saw.
Wow.
And the book argues this doesn't diminish her, but actually reframes where her strength and compassion came from. It wasn't like constant divine comfort. It was heroic faith, despite feeling absolutely nothing.
50 years of that. That's just staggering.
So, okay, let's unpack this. How did we even get such an intimate look? I mean, this kind of struggle wasn't public knowledge at all, was it? It must have been sealed away.
It absolutely was. The key is the author, Father Brian Colady Shuck. He's a priest with the Missionaries of Charity Fathers, the order she co-founded, and knew her personally for over 20 years.
Okay, so he was close to her.
Yes. But crucially, he was also the postulator for her cause for beatification and canonization.
The postulator? What exactly does that mean?
Think of it as the lead advocate. The person responsible for gathering all the evidence meticulously to support someone's case for sainthood in the Catholic Church. Ah, okay. So that role gave him special access.
Exactly. It granted him exclusive access to everything, her personal writings, diaries, and maybe most importantly, her letters to her spiritual directors and superiors. These were documents never meant for public eyes, sealed for decades.
So we're talking unfiltered, private thoughts.
Precisely. And Father Colady Chuck's goal wasn't to, you know, tear down her image, but to present the real Mother Teresa. He actually argues that this hidden inner torment is maybe the most compelling proof of her heroic sanctity.
That it makes her more saintly, not less. That's a fascinating angle.
It really is.
Okay, so we have this incredible access. Let's go back then. Before this profound darkness set in, what was her spiritual life like? You said she was a nun before starting her famous work.
Right. Before all this, as Sister Teresa, she was a Loreto nun. The Loreto sisters focus on education, and she was teaching, even became a principal in Calcutta. By all accounts, she was content, zealous, filled with spiritual fervor.
So feeling connected to God.
Very much so. Her early life involved genuine mystical experiences, a strong sense of God's presence, real closeness, not the darkness we're talking about later.
So what changed? There must have been a trigger point.
There was a huge one. September 10th, 1946. She was on a train ride to Darjeeling for a retreat. She described experiencing what she called a call within a call.
A call within a call.
Yeah, basically a series of profound mystical experiences. She mentioned divine locutions like inner spiritual messages believed to be directly from God and even direct communications from Jesus.
Wow. Okay. And what was the message?
Very clear. Very imperative. Leave the convent, go out and serve the poorest of the poor right there in the slums of Calcutta. And this period, it was marked by incredible clarity, joy, and intense feeling of union with Jesus. It's also interesting, the book mentions a private vow she made back in 1942.
Oh, yeah.
She vowed to give God anything that he may ask, not to refuse him anything. The book sort of suggests this might have been the spiritual groundwork for the trials that came later.
Like a contract she unknowingly signed up for. Okay, so here's where it gets really interesting, right? She's having these intense experiences, gets this clear mission, and then...
You said the shift was almost immediate.
Almost immediate. Quite dramatic. As soon as she got permission from her superiors and actually began her work in the slums around 1948, the spiritual consolations just stopped. Vanished. The light went out. And this was the start of what she called the darkness.
And this darkness, you said, lasted?
Almost 50 years. Right up until her death in 1997.
Unbelievable. What did she say about it in those private letters?
Oh, her words are incredibly raw. Painful, really. She wrote things like, "The place of God in my soul is blank." She spoke of a terrible sense of loss.
Emptiness.
Complete emptiness. She agonized over the silence, and the emptiness is so great, and maybe the most heartbreaking. She questioned her own faith. Where is my faith? Even deep down, there is nothing but emptiness and darkness.
Goodness. She must have felt utterly alone. Did she think she'd made a mistake, that the call wasn't real? She genuinely feared that. She worried the initial call was a delusion, that her whole life's work was maybe a failure because she couldn't feel God in it.
Hearing those words, it's just profoundly unsettling. How does she keep going? I mean, with that level of internal desolation, it's almost impossible to imagine.
It really is.
Because this is the great paradox, isn't it? Externally, her mission is exploding. Global attention, followers flocking to her, the missionaries of charity growing.
Exactly. Flourishing on the outside.
While internally, she's in this spiritual void. Mm. How did she not just crumble, give up? What kept her putting one foot in front of the other?
This is where spiritual guidance becomes absolutely essential. There was one figure in particular, Father Joseph Neuner, a Jesuit priest. He was pivotal.
How so? What did he tell her?
Well, he helped her reframe it all. He suggested her suffering wasn't a sign that God was angry or that she'd failed. Instead, he identified it as a genuine dark night of the soul, a classic concept in Christian mysticism.
Okay, a dark night. What did that mean for her?
He connected it directly to Christ's suffering. Specifically, Christ's cry on the cross, you know, my God, why have you forsaken me? And also, his words, I thirst.
I thirst.
Yeah, interpreted not just as physical thirst, but a thirst for love, for souls. Father Neuner helped her see her darkness as a unique way of participating in Christ's feeling of abandonment and her work as quenching that divine thirst.
So her pain wasn't meaningless anymore.
Exactly. It suddenly had a redemptive purpose. It transformed from this unbearable torment into the very heart of her calling. She wasn't just suffering despite her mission. Her suffering became part of her mission to connect with Christ's own desolation.
Wow, that's an incredible shift in perspective, turning utter despair into a profound connection. Okay, so given this extraordinary inner journey forged in that darkness, how did it shape her actual beliefs, her core philosophy? What does this all mean for how we understand what drove her?
Well, her core philosophy, really born from this paradox, highlights some powerful themes that I think really reshape how we might think about faith. First, and maybe foremost, is faith as a choice, not a feeling.
Okay, explain that.
Her life becomes this powerful demonstration that true faith isn't necessarily about feeling good or feeling God's presence constantly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a decision, an act of the will. She chose to believe, chose to serve, even when all those feelings were just gone, stripped away.
That's quite a challenge to how we often think about faith today, isn't it? We often equate it with strong emotion or certainty.
Right. We often prioritize the emotional experience. Her life suggests something maybe grittier, more tenacious. It was an act of sheer will day after day for decades.
Okay, faith is a choice. What else?
Second, the thirst of Jesus.
Hmm.
This became the central motto, the real driving force for the missionaries of charity.
Right, you mentioned Father Neuner connecting her darkness to Jesus' thirst.
Exactly. She wasn't seen as physical thirst, but as Jesus' deep, divine longing for love, for souls, for reciprocity from humanity, as the book puts it.
Yeah.
So her work and her inner suffering were seen as her way of responding to, of quenching that divine thirst.
Connecting her own emptiness to fulfilling a divine need. That's profound.
It is. Then third, and this one is really striking visually, is the smile as a cloak.
Ah, yes. Everyone remembers her smile.
But the book reveals it was often a conscious, deliberate act, a tool of her ministry, an act of love.
Mm.
She chose to radiate a light and joy she herself didn't feel, specifically to bring hope to others.
She actually said that.
She did. There's a quote. The smile is a big cloak that covers a multitude of pains.
Wow. That really makes you think, doesn't it? Especially in our age of like radical authenticity. She chose to present strength not as deception, but as a gift.
Precisely. It suggests a different kind of integrity. Maybe one focused outward on the needs of others rather than inward on just expressing her own state.
Mm. Okay. What else?
Fourth. Her darkness gave her this profound identification with the spiritual poverty of the poor. It wasn't just about lacking food or shelter. She came to deeply understand and, in a way, share that deeper poverty, the feeling of being unwanted, unloved, abandoned by God himself.
So she wasn't just serving them from a position of, like, spiritual wealth?
Not at all. It connected her to the outcasts she served on an incredibly intimate level. She knew that emptiness firsthand. She wasn't some spiritually superior figure looking down. She was a fellow sufferer.
That changes things. And the last theme.
Finally, she really came to understand the redemptive power of suffering. She moved from seeing her darkness as a personal failure or a sign of God's absence to eventually embracing it. She called it a precious treasure.
A treasure? How?
Because it was a gift, she believed, that allowed her to share intimately in Christ's passion. There's another powerful quote. I have come to love the darkness, for I believe now that it is a part, a very, very small part, of Jesus' darkness and pain on earth.
So her holiness wasn't in spite of the darkness, but somehow because of it, or at least forged within it.
You could definitely say that. It shows holiness isn't just about bliss and miracles, but maybe more about heroic faithfulness, about love, when everything feels empty. Her suffering, once she reframed it and embraced it, became part of her path to sanctity. It truly redefines our understanding of strength and maybe even holiness itself.
It absolutely does. It shifts it from something otherworldly to something incredibly painfully human. So how can we connect this to our own lives? I mean, her experience was extreme, obviously, but are there universal lessons here, even for those of us who aren't religious?
Oh, definitely. Her struggles, her perseverance, they speak to really common human experiences. Think about embracing perseverance through doubt. Her life is just this incredible example of sticking to your commitments, whether it's a career, a relationship, a project, even when the initial excitement, the positive feelings, completely disappear.
Right. We all face that, don't we, when the passion fades?
Exactly. She teaches us to build our lives on our decisions, our choices, not just on fleeting emotions. How many times do we give up on something important just because the feeling isn't there anymore? She modeled sticking with the choice.
That's a powerful takeaway right there. What else?
Well, there's finding meaning in suffering and darkness. Her journey offers a way to look at our own hardships, maybe loneliness, periods of depression, failures, and reframe them. Instead of seeing them as just pointless pain, maybe they're opportunities.
Opportunities for what?
For deeper empathy. For connection. Her story encourages you to ask, okay, this hurts, but how might this pain actually connect me to what others are going through? It suggests even in our darkest times, there might be a hidden potential for growth and understanding.
Turning personal struggle into a bridge to others, that's helpful.
It is. And related to that, there's the simple practical power of small, consistent actions. You know, her famous motto, do small things with great love. Well, knowing about her inner state gives it even more depth. When she felt completely empty, overwhelmed by the darkness, she focused on the immediate task, the one small, concrete act of love right in front of her.
Like a practical strategy for when things feel too big?
Exactly.
Yeah.
When the big picture is daunting or feels meaningless, just focus on that one small, kind thing you can do right now. It's a lifeline, really, for anyone feeling overwhelmed.
That's very applicable. Any final lesson?
Yeah, I think her life really pushes us towards redefining success and fulfillment. Our culture often ties success so tightly to feeling happy, feeling fulfilled.
Right, the pursuit of happiness.
Her life challenges that. It suggests that a truly successful life, a meaningful life, might be defined more by faithfulness to a purpose, to service, regardless of the internal emotional rewards. It's kind of an antidote to needing constant positive feedback or feelings to feel like you're succeeding.
Purpose over personal feeling. That really does make her feel profoundly more human, more relatable, and maybe, strangely, a more relevant guide for our often skeptical times when people grapple so much with doubt and finding meaning.
I absolutely agree.
Okay, so as we wrap up this deep dive, let's try to distill this incredible story into three core takeaways.
Okay, first I'd say an emotional insight. Perhaps the most moving lesson is seeing her unwavering love and service continue, even when she felt completely abandoned, even unloved by God. It really teaches you about a pure form of love, one that gives everything without expecting anything back, not even inner peace or consolation. It's love at its most heroic, maybe.
Love is sheer gift, regardless of personal cost. Got it.
Second, an intellectual insight. Her journey just fundamentally reshapes how we might understand faith. It wasn't about emotional highs or mystical visions for most of her life. It was about this gritty, stubborn, unwavering commitment, a choice made again and again in the face of absolute emptiness. It's faith as heroic fidelity of the will.
Faith as an action, a sustained choice, not just a belief or feeling.
Yeah. And third, a universal insight. Our own personal dark nights, those times of doubt, loneliness, struggle, failure, they aren't necessarily signs that we've gone wrong. They can actually be profound opportunities. They can deepen our empathy, connect us more closely to the suffering that's just part of being human, and maybe even be the very place where our most authentic, lasting sense of purpose is forged.
Our struggles aren't just obstacles, but potential crucibles for meaning and connection.
That's powerful. Thank you for unpacking all of that. It leaves us with a lot to think about. And here's a final thought for you, our listeners, to ponder. In a world that often prizes radical transparency, what can we learn from Mother Teresa's smile as a cloak? Her conscious choice to radiate joy while suffering intensely about the nuanced integrity of choosing how we present our inner struggles, not for deception, but as a deliberate act of love and hope for those we serve. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.